Right now in downtown Butler, I'm Tracy Morgan in the Next Year Bank studios with WISR 680 AM. Dave Malarkey is up next with It's Your Turn. Thanks so much for joining us and have a good day.
And now, It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's Your Turn. Weekdays from 12:30 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's Your Turn. 724-283-2525. And now, It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey.
With us on the Wednesday edition of It's Your Turn, middle of the week, over the hump day, and I tell you what, we're almost over the hump for June, too. That's hard to believe. By the end of this week, Friday, we'll be halfway through June. Wow. Good show today. We have several guests. We're going to be talking a little bit later with Jeff Kroner, who's the director of the Musicians Concert Band. They will be starting their series of summer concerts very soon. And this is a tradition that goes back years and years and years, back through Blaze Scarnati and even earlier than that. So we'll talk about that. And also today, we'll be chatting with, and you know, on this program, we always try to present different views, different points of view. Sometimes we talk with conservatives, sometimes with progressives and liberals. Today we're going to be talking with a spokesperson from the Republican National Committee to get their point of view on the Singapore summit. Now, there have been mixed reviews on whether or not it was good or bad, so we'll see what Mark Lauder will be speaking with us. He's a former press secretary, by the way, for Vice President Mike Pence. So he'll be visiting with us later on the program today. First of all, though, we say hello to an acquaintance of long standing, and that's a local historian and a storyteller, Bill May. Bill, good to see you, as always.
Nice to see you, Dave. Thanks for having me.
You are going to be presenting another one of your fascinating bits of local history. It's tomorrow night, right?
Tomorrow night at 6:30 in the Carousel Shelter of Alameda Park, and it's going to be a beautiful evening.
This is part of the Discovery series of programs running Thursday nights throughout the summer, sponsored by the Butler County Parks and Recreation Department. And you have spoken there before on a variety of subjects. Your topic this time is the history of Butler's movie theaters.
Yeah, I take the audience from the first Opera House, which they really didn't have operas then, but it was a performing arts center back in the 1870s, up through all the movie theaters that people would either remember themselves or heard their parents or grandparents talk about. For instance, the Majestic, the Capitol, the Lyric, the Penn, and Butler's grand movie palace, the Butler Theater.
The Majestic building is still there. It's been subdivided into physicians' offices and storage and a bunch of other stuff. But the building still stands, right? That's the original Majestic Theater?
That is the original Majestic Theater. And I have, through hours and hours and hours of combing through old movie industry magazines, uncovered original interior photos of the Majestic. So people, if they come to the program tomorrow evening, they'll get to see what the Majestic looked like in its heyday, as well as, interestingly enough, if you look at the building, which sits at the corner of Cunningham and South McCain Street.
It's right across the street from the newest tier parking garage.
Correct.
Yeah.
If you look at the very top, the windows are boarded up, unfortunately, but on the top floor was also a dance hall. So people get to see photos of the dance hall and some stories about it as well.
I've wondered about that because when you look at it from the outside, I've never been inside. Well, I've been in a couple of the offices on the ground floor, but I've never been inside to look around. And it's kind of hard to picture, you know, how that could have been a movie theater. Number one, it looks like it's too big. It looks like it's too tall. I didn't know there was something else on top of the movie theater.
Well, it originally seated 1,500 people.
Oh.
And, of course, had the ground floor and had a couple of balconies. And it was absolutely beautiful inside with gold leaf ornamentation. The proscenium, which is the arch going over the stage, was gold leaf. And it was a beautiful place. Now, it was built in 1904 before movies. Mm-hmm. So it was originally built for plays and for vaudeville. And then, of course, they transitioned slowly into showing movies, which most people alive today that went there would remember it mainly for the movies, though they still continued to have live entertainment.
Wow, balconies, gilded proscenium. It would kind of be Butler's answer to Hines Hall, I guess, really.
It would kind of remind you of Hines Hall or the Benedum a little bit. And then, you know, we also, the other building's still intact. Of course, people know the Penn is still there. And where the, and people understand this if they come to my talk, but where the Capitol Theater was, which originally was built as the Lyric, next door to it, and where I'm talking about is where the Brick House restaurant now sits. Both parts of it. There's two buildings there. Now, if you look at the Brick House, the one part that used to be Eaton Park, and then the other half where they have the open-air seating, both those buildings were theaters. So where you have the open-air seating was originally the Lyric. And then I have a fascinating story about arson that takes place there, which then leads to the building of the new Lyric, which is where the Eaton Park Park is now. So the one side turns into the Grand, the other side turns into the Lyric, and then the one side turns into the State, and the Lyric turns into the Capitol.
Wow. Didn't that at one point, compared to the whole history of the theater, it's fairly recent, I would say, 30, maybe 40 years ago, wasn't there a cleaners in there as well?
And there was Capitol cleaners in there. And I do have to thank... The one nice thing about growing up in Butler, you never know when connections you had as a kid playing basketball will pay dividends. And Larry Gettler, who owns those buildings, was very gracious with me and took me into the buildings. And the upper part of the Lyric / Capitol Theater is still intact. So Larry took me in and let me take photos of the proscenium and the balcony and the walls. So people will get to see in color the pictures of kind of what that theater looked like. So I really want to thank him because it really lends to my talk to have the modern day photos. And I was also fortunate enough to find pictures of the original theater inside with stained glass windows.
Oh, wow.
And the exterior when it first opened in 1915 as the Lyric from the architectural archives at CMU. So I have lots and lots of photos of all these theaters, including interiors of the Butler Theater, which unfortunately now we did what Butler does best or does worst. They tore down that beautiful movie palace, which was designed by one of the nation's foremost theater architects, a man by the name of John Eberson, and tore the Butler down to have a, well, to put in a drive-in bank, which now it's just a parking lot.
Yeah.
But if people will be amazed if you do not remember going to the Butler Theater. You will be amazed what an incredible piece of beauty that was inside.
I'm not sure whether I can ever remember being inside or not. I think when I was a kid, I went to one or two shows in there. I did not grow up in Butler, but our family came here for shopping and everything else. Listeners, if you're not quite sure where Bill May is talking about, this would have been not quite across the street from the old hot dog shop, but pretty close.
Right.
Actually, I think it butted up against the former Kirkpatrick Sporting Goods store.
Correct. So it's between South McCain Street Well, actually, right across from the new hotel is where it's at.
Yes, exactly. That's the best way to put it nowadays, because everybody knows where the new hotel is. It was a long, kind of a narrow building. It really didn't have a great big storefront, did it?
And yet it seated 2,000 people.
Oh, my gosh, I had no idea.
So when you were actually in the theater, it seemed much, much larger than it does when you look at the lot as being vacant now.
Mm-hmm.
So it seated all, and it was the first air-conditioned theater in town.
You know, I can remember that as a kid. You used to see that before air conditioning was widespread like it is now. You would pass a movie theater in many towns, and it would say, come on in, we're air-conditioned. I mean, people would go to the movies to cool off as much as seeing the film.
And that probably was one of the first to be air-conditioned, because it opened in 1930. So that's a very early stage of air conditioning. They actually had an ice plant in the basement to create the air conditioning for
this
that theater.
Primitive air conditioning.
Primitive, but hey, in 1930, if it's 90 degrees out and you didn't have air conditioning in your house, probably not even a fan. Going to the movie theater that was air conditioned was a big event.
Now, the Majestic, you said, was built in
1904,
and the Butler, no longer there, was 1930?
That's when it opened.
When it opened, okay. What about the other two? What are, you have approximate dates on
the
those?
The Penn?
Yeah.
The Penn was opened 80 years ago this April 22nd. So it opened on April 22nd, 1938.
Mm-hmm.
And Bing Crosby and W.C. Field sent letters of congratulations to the theater owners at the time for the opening of the Penn.
Have you been in that building recently? Because it hasn't been open.
I've been in there, I think, a year or so ago. I was in the Penn, and I, again, from spending more hours than I'd like to remember combing through magazines, found the original photos of the opening of the Penn Theater.
Mm.
So people coming to the talk will be able to see what it looked like in its heyday.
Now, you have, at your talk tomorrow night, it's tomorrow night, folks, Thursday.
6:30? Thursday at 6:30, Carousel Shelter, Alameda Park.
And it's free.
And it's free.
No admission.
Just bring
check.
A smile.
But you will have photographs that you'll be showing. And
dozens of photographs, movie clips of some of the movies that were shown there. And here's a cool thing. If anyone is probably in their 50s or older, they will remember rushing home from school at 3:30 to watch Paul Shannon's Adventure Time on Channel 4.
I remember that. He's the guy that brought the Three Stooges to Pittsburgh all the time.
He revived their careers.
Yeah.
They had been forgotten until Paul Shannon started to show their shorts again, and that grew all over the country to where they started making movies. And to thank Paul Shannon, one of their movies, 1965, about the Outlaws the Outlaws are coming. They gave Paul Shannon a part in that movie, and he played Wild Bill Hickok. But Paul became so popular that he would tour around the area and appear at the different theaters. In those days, there were kids' shows in the afternoons or in the mornings. And I found a video clip of the Penn Theater, of the kids waiting outside the Penn Theater for Paul Shannon to have his show inside.
Mm.
So if you come tomorrow night at 6:30 in the Carousel Shelter of Alameda Park, you'll see this movie clip, live clip, of kids standing outside on Butler's Main Street, outside the Penn Theater, as well as Paul Shannon standing on the stage. There was a stage in the Penn,
mm-hmm.
with his magic sword bringing the curtain down.
Probably had his name up on the marquee, too, right? Paul Shannon.
Paul Shannon.
Channel 4. Wow. So how do you show? Do you set up a screen at the Carousel Shelter?
Big screen.
That's how you show these video clips and everything?
They're all on the screen. I do it on PowerPoint, and it's a big show.
Where the heck did you ever find all these video clips?
Searched. It was an adventure doing the research for this talk, to find all these photos and all the stories. It's not just pictures. I have lots of stories about famous performers who performed live on stage. And if anyone in the audience went to see the movie Barnum, mm-hmm. which...
Fairly recent.
Fairly recent movie this year. Very popular. They'll know one of the characters in the movie Barnum was Tom Thumb, who was a little person that Barnum brought to fame, became the most famous entertainer in the entire world, performed to the heads of states of Europe, every continent. But Tom Thumb came and performed here in Butler at one of our opera houses. So I have the story behind Tom Thumb and his trip to Butler with his troupe, as he called it, of little people.
That was back in the day, unfortunately, when the little folks were treated differently than we ever would today. They weren't treated as freaks or anything like that, but it was kind of a sideshow thing. It was sad in a way, you know?
I think that with Tom Thumb, he was a performer in his own right. So you would not have billed him as having been exploited as a sideshow.
Mm-hmm.
He was the show.
You've mentioned the Opera House. Do you know where that was, and is that building still existent?
Well, we had three opera houses.
Oh, my. Three of them?
Three of them.
Wow.
And I have pictures of all three of them, as well as some great stories about some of the performers and the fires that would take two out of the three. Matter of fact, my great-grandfather was playing in the orchestra in the opera house that sat where Morgan Center now sits on its last night before it burned down. Kind of interesting, I'll tell a little story. The last person who performed at the opera house, and, you know, they brought in plays and speakers, and the last person who performed on the stage at the opera house was a Confederate general by the name of General John B. Gordon.
Hmm.
And John B. Gordon was staying at the Central Hotel at the time, which later would become the Nixon Hotel. But he stood on that stage and he told a wonderful story, probably the last story told on that opera house stage, that at the Battle of Gettysburg in 1863, there was a Union colonel by the name of Barlow. And he had been wounded as Gordon's troops were piercing his lines. And Barlow was wounded on the ground, and John B. Gordon got off his horse and stopped to give him a drink of water, read him one of his wife's letters, and then kindly sent him to the rear to be nursed, but had figured that he had died. Fast forward about 15, 20 years, and a congressman invites John B. Gordon to dinner, as well as Francis Barlow, who actually survived those wounds. Now, Gordon believes Barlow was dead. Barlow had read that a General Gordon had been killed outside of Richmond on May 11th of 1864. So the two meet at this congressman's house. And Barlow, when he shakes his hand, says, "Are you related to the General Barlow who was killed at Meadow Bridge and who nursed me at the Battle of Gettysburg?" He goes, "I am that man." And then Gordon says to Barlow, "Are you related to the Colonel Barlow who I gave a drink to on the Gettysburg battlefield?" And Barlow said, "I am that man."
Wow.
The two were astonished. And here we had North and South, and this is kind of a good lesson for today when there's so much controversy between Confederate monuments, that here you had two opposing men, both who thought they had been killed by their own sides, one Union, one Confederate. They meet at this house, find each other, and became lifelong friends, and were able to bridge that gap of resentment from the American Civil War.
What a great story. We're chatting, listeners, if you've joined us a little bit late on this segment of It's Your Turn, welcome for sure. We're chatting with Bill May, local historian, And not only that, I mean, there's a lot of historians that can't tell a story. Bill May can do both. He researches history, and he's a great storyteller, and he's going to be making a presentation tomorrow night, that's Thursday, at the Carousel Chowder at Alameda Park on the history of Butler's movie theaters. So this opera house that was up there on the Diamond, it burned down?
It burned down, and that night, as it's burning, it catches on fire in the early morning hours. And General Gordon is staying in the Central Hotel, and they're trying to evacuate the hotel. And Gordon says, "I'm not leaving till I finish my breakfast." So I'm guessing from being in all the fire and fury of the American Civil War, just a little fire next door really didn't worry him too much.
That was back in the days when fires, especially in a city, you know, like Butler, where the buildings are so close together, that was a real danger. I mean, you could wipe out a half a block, a whole block very easily.
Well, particularly since the third floor was the armory, and it had 1,200 rounds of ammunition going off because of the fire was burning.
Wow, wow. And that would have been back in the days, probably with a horse-drawn fire engine, right?
Yeah, it burned to the ground.
Yeah, one of those old pumpers where they had three guys on each side manning the pump. Fascinating stuff. So, and you say one of the other opera houses also burned down?
The second opera house sat at the corner of Wayne and South McCain. And it originally had been what we know now as St. Mark's Lutheran Church.
Hmm.
And then St. Mark's moved down to, I believe it's a location now,
mm-hmm.
different church though, in 1884, and then it was purchased and converted to an opera house.
It's amazing that a town the size of Butler, and it would have been smaller back in those days,
way smaller,
could support three opera houses.
Well, they were not in business at the same time.
Oh, okay.
They replaced each other as time went on. But we did support all those movie theaters. Mm-hmm. We had, at one time, we had the Majestic open. We had the Grand open, or the State open, the Capitol, the Penn, and the Butler.
Mm. Of course, the big difference from today is that they were all single-screen theaters, mm-hmm. whereas today we have the multiplexes. Yeah. Still, it's pretty amazing that there were that many of them open at the same time.
Well, if you look at the statistics around 1940, about 58% of the people in the country went to the movie theaters once a week, compared to 3% today.
They also had, in addition to the feature film that was being screened, they had newsreels. And in the days before television, that was the only way that people could see video of world wars and other happenings around the world.
It was really a whole evening of entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the kids' shows. The audience, if they come tomorrow night at 6:30, will see pictures of the kids sitting for the Butler Eagle Christmas party at the Capitol Theater back in the 1940s.
Mm.
And the kids from Armco's Christmas party lined up half a block long waiting to get into the Penn Theater for their Christmas party. And they'd have live entertainers, show cartoons, show a movie, and it would just be packed.
They also had, back in the day, what were known as cereals. And I'm not talking about Rice Krispies and Cheerios here. I'm talking about cereal films, shorts. Which would feature the same characters over and over again, and they always had a cliffhanger ending so that you would come back the next week to see the next installment of this serial to see what happened.
And tomorrow night we'll watch a clip of one of those serials that showed at the Capitol Theater.
Hmm.
And we'll also, I also in my talk about a couple of famous movie stars who came from Butler, one from the silent era, and one from the modern era, or the era of the 1940s and 50s.
We had movie stars that came from
Butler? We had a couple of, we had the Jim Carrey of the silent era, and then we had a beautiful girl by the name of Joan Cheeseman, who would go by the name of Joan Chandler. So I show where she grew up and some stories about her, and we take a look at her movie that premiered at the Butler Theater and her parents being presented with flowers from the theater manager as they were going in for the premiere of Butler, of one of its own.
Premiere movies back in those days were a much bigger thing than they are now.
I think people are, particularly younger people, would be amazed that people used to line up around a block just to go to a movie. Mm-hmm. That's something that they'll probably never experience at the multiplex. But in the old days of single screens, that's what you would have.
And the popcorn wasn't as expensive back then either.
No, they didn't have to make all their money off of the popcorn. And, hey, people tomorrow night will also learn how popcorn began to be sold in theaters.
Get out. Really? Wow. I bet part of it had to do with the aroma. Because when you walk into a movie theater and you smell that popcorn, you just have to have popcorn, you know?
Well, it has to do with money.
Well, of course.
It has to do with money. Everything has to do with money.
I wonder if anybody has any old ticket stubs from some of the theaters when they were in operation way back then.
Oh, I'd love to see. I haven't had anyone come to me to show me an old ticket stub. I did, around the corner from me, a neighbor who I hope to have a picture by tomorrow evening of it, actually owns some of the original seats from the Butler Theater and popcorn machine. So I'm hoping to get photos of those for tomorrow evening to add to my program.
Most of these movie theaters had a stage, right? If not all of them.
All the ones built downtown all had stages.
So they would take the screen up if they had a live performance, and the stage would be right behind the screen.
Correct. And as they slowly get built into the more modern era, the stages got smaller and smaller. Mm-hmm. Well, I should say they got bigger for a while, and then they slowly got smaller. Where, for instance, the Penn was really built for movies. Same thing with the Butler. But so they had smaller stages because they were mainly going to be movie houses.
They also needed at least somewhat of an orchestra pit, because before talkies in silent movies, they usually had somebody down there playing a piano or something, right, as the movie wore on.
Right. One of the theaters we'll talk about, not really well remembered because it closed in 29, which was called the Kameek, which sat where there's kind of a nursery lot now across from Rite Aid at the corner of Jefferson
and Maine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it had an orchestra pit for a five-piece orchestra, as well as it had a Wurlitzer organ that was put in.
Did we ever have any big-name entertainers who came to Butler
We had a lot of big names. Matter of fact, there's a story, a legendary guy from your station here, Warren Eilenfeld.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful man. And I have a story about him when he was in high school, or just out of high school, and maybe just beginning work at, I think he was still in high school, or maybe beginning work here for the radio station.
I think actually that he kind of worked emptying waste baskets or something at WISR when he was still in high school.
But I have a story about him at the Butler Theater, where he gets to go and interview one of the famous performers who's going to put on a concert there. And it has a funny ending to the story. But you'll have to come tomorrow night to hear that tale.
You ought to write a book about this. But you're already in the process of writing a couple of history books, aren't you?
Well, I'd like to write one on the Biddle Boys, which I'll be presenting on August 16th, Thursday night, August 16th, at the Carousel Shelter. And possibly, just if I can announce another event I'm going to do.
Oh, please do. Yeah.
July 28th at 6:30. I'm going to lead a walking tour of the historic neighborhood of North McCain, East Fulton, and East Pearl Street.
There is a movement, at least, a nascent movement, to declare that section of town a historic district.
And there is a lot of history stories connected to that, that people come on the walk. And I can only take 25 people, so it'll sell out quickly. Now, the event tomorrow night at the Carousel is free. The walking tour will be $12, and they can actually call if they'd like to make a reservation. Prepayment is required. If they would like to call, they can call 724-256-9026 to make a reservation for that walk. It's about 0.6 miles. There are some hill climbs, if people know that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But those houses have some really wonderful historical tales to be told. Connections to Abraham Lincoln, Mark Twain, the Underground Railroad, even a front page murder story all takes place on this walk that I'll be doing on July 28th.
Many of those historic huge home mansions almost are still extant.
Most of them are still there. Yeah. With, you know, again, great stories behind their building, the people that lived there, events that took place. So that will be, again, July 28th at 6:30 p.m.
One of them was featured, I don't know whether you saw this or not, in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette this past Sunday. It's now for sale. Victorian, I think they called it a Victorian mansion, owned by Mrs. Holton, recently put on the market.
Oh, that's my next-door neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the whole history behind that house that you'll hear on the walk, and that's actually connected to a major fashion designer who's the grandson of the, not the builder, but the person who moved in there and added on to the house. And I have an original photo of that house from 1878 when it was built.
Hmm. 1878. Wow. Long time ago.
Long time ago.
Yeah. Well, check out the Post Gazette Sunday.
I will look at
pictures in there, exterior and interior of the home. Yeah. So that's coming up again in, did you say in August?
July 28th. At 6:30, meeting approximately or on North McCain Street, but by the Little Theater. Mm-hmm. That's where it will start and end. And we'll go up McCain, stop and along the way to the houses, stop at Elm Court, then go up East Fulton, down Elm and down East Pearl Street, so people can gauge whether that is too strenuous for them or not. But it's about a 0.6 walk.
And what's the phone number again if people want to register for that?
724-256-9026.
Mm-hmm. That's coming up at the end of July. Coming up tomorrow night, free, no admission. Is Bill's talk on the history of Butler's movie theaters. You'll get to see the results of a great deal of research, obviously, that Bill May has done, going to libraries and online and everything else to get all these pictures and video clips and everything else, plus the stories, the wonderful stories. What do you take, about an hour or so? Or?
It's 15 minutes to an hour long.
Mm-hmm. 6:30 tomorrow night.
6:30.
Good to see you again, Bill May.
Thank you so much for having me, Dave. Yeah. I always enjoy it.
Oh, it's always fun. Educational is fun to talk to you. Yeah. Nice to have you here. More to come on It's Your Turn. And we're scheduled to chat with Jeff Croner coming up in just a moment or so. Jeff is not only the head instructor of the band at Butler Senior High School, but he's also the director of the Musicians Concert Band. And we're going to be talking about their summer concert series and probably some other stuff, too. Jeff will be with us very shortly. We'll take a quick break. Back with more of It's Your Turn here on WISR right after these words. We all love the smell of fresh-cut grass, flowers blooming, and a nice warm rain. But those often mean that it's time for allergies. At Institute Hill Pharmacy, you will get the personalized care for your allergies that you deserve. Zyrtec, Allegra, Claritin, and all of your allergy prescription needs can be taken care of at Institute Hill Pharmacy, 937 East Jefferson Street in Butler, or call them at 724-285-3693. And make sure to like them on Facebook. Institute Hill Pharmacy, an old-fashioned pharmacy just the way you remember. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family.
Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
WISR presents the Father's Day Sweepstakes. All you have to do is go to WISR680.com, click on the Father's Day Sweepstakes banner, and register to win a $100 gift certificate to Fern Valley Nursery on Meridian Road in Renfrew. Entries will be taken until 11 p.m. Thursday, June 14th. Our winner will be notified via email and announced during Coffee with Kate on Friday, June the 15th. The WISR Father's Day Sweepstakes presented by Fern Valley Nursery.
Welcome back, good friends. We welcome an acquaintance of long standing here in the studio for the next segment of It's Your Turn. Jeff Croner visits with us. Jeff, good to see you as always.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Another summer of concerts by the Musicians Concert Band is going to be getting underway this week and continuing through the summer. And boy, you talk about a rich tradition. This Musicians Concert Band has been around for a while, Jeff.
Well, Blaise Garnotti, Mr. S, and Mike Formick put this together all the way back in 1986. And we started off playing on platforms, and everybody would bring their lawn chairs. And, you know, after about 10 years of swatting mosquitoes and dodging raindrops and having to pin your music to your stand because the wind might take it, they moved it inside. And we've been playing, you know, concert band style music inside ever since. It's been 33 years.
This is so much a part of Americana, of, you know, small city, small town American history. When you think of, think of the great Broadway musical, The Music Man, or the film, if you haven't seen the play, where they had a gazebo in the center of town and they had a community band that played. It was entertainment.
Each community that would have that, there was a sense of pride.
Absolutely.
Who could put that band together. And it wasn't just the kids in high school, obviously. It was anybody that could play. And that was their entertainment on a Saturday night. You know, everyone would go, take their picnics. And, you know, I know I've seen some different shows, the Jack Daniels Cornet Band, you know, and it was a show just about that. You know, how the communities each had their own little band. And Butler is super, super fortunate to have their own band called the Musicians Concert Band.
The name Sal Signorino will mean a lot to many of our listeners. Music man from years gone by. And this was kind of a dream of his, wasn't it?
Well, Sal did have a band, and much of the music that we started off with 33 years ago had come from Sal Signorino's basement. He had a group, and when he was no longer able to do that, it just didn't work out. Mike Formick and Blaise Garnotti, as I said, Mr. S, saw that void, and with the help of the university and with the local federation, the local union of musicians, they put this together, and it's just, as I said, it's just grown and continued to kind of go with the times and entertained our crowds for 33 seasons.
Sal Signorino, a legend in the minds of many, but there will be some listeners who don't know who he was. He was a music teacher.
He was a long, long time music teacher and jazz musician in the Butler area. What's kind of exciting is I have his grandson in the marching band. So it has come all the way back around, and here we go.
He taught in the Butler Area School District?
Yes, he did.
Did they have a marching band back in those days?
Absolutely. Now, Sal didn't work with the marching band. He was working with, primarily when I met him, the elementary school.
I see.
He was teaching the kids at the beginning. I know he worked at Broad Street and Oakland, and I'm sure the way many of those teachers were, he was probably at quite a few of the schools getting those kids excited about music.
Some schools, by the way, have a band, but it's not necessarily a marching band. There's concert band, too.
Absolutely.
Where they don't go out to parades or anything, but they perform in auditoriums.
Butler has all of those. We have, obviously, our, you know, outstanding world-renowned marching band, as well as all of our concert bands and choirs and orchestras and jazz bands. And, you know, we're very blessed to have a school that still supports music like they do. I couldn't ask for more. Our superintendent and school board have made it very obvious that this is something that they believe in, educating the whole child, and music is very, very important to them.
Well, back to the summer series. For several years now, the Butler Intermediate High School Auditorium has been the venue for the Musicians Concert Band. Is that the case this summer as well?
It is indeed. I can't even remember the timeline, but Miller Auditorium was closed down for renovations and still is. And because I teach here in Butler and I have access to things, it just made perfect sense to move it here to the Butler Intermediate High School. It's very comfortable. Parking is usually pretty spacious. It's air conditioned, so even if we have a very hot and muggy night, it's usually, actually sometimes it's a little cooler. Mm-hmm. So if you're somebody that wants to come and you're a little more cold-blooded, you might want to bring a sweater because it can be a little bit chilly, but it's just a beautiful hall.
What a change from the original days when you were batting mosquitoes and suffering the outdoor heat. And the wind sometimes, which if you're a musician, wind blows music around. That can be a problem.
It can. You know, we would pin it up with clothespins, which these young kids don't even know what a clothespin is anymore. But, you know, it was whatever it would take. And if that wind really blew and you had a hard section, you better be able to kind of look sideways.
You know, I read an interesting story in the Post-Gazette some years ago now. It may have been when they tore down the Civic Arena, the old Mellon Arena, which was built, by the way, not as a hockey venue. It was built to house the Civic Light Opera in Pittsburgh. Now, they did use it for hockey, of course, but it was mainly built for the Civic Light Opera, which puts on Broadway shows in the summertime. And that's why they had the roof that would open up.
Right.
They thought, wow, wouldn't this be great? We can have these summer concerts and it'll be like it's outside. What they apparently never thought about was the wind.
Mm-hmm.
And this story in the Post actually had pictures. When you set up a stage, and I actually saw some stage shows in that old Civic Arena, you have to use curtains. You have to, I mean, it's a big hollow dome. You have to create some sort of a stage look. And they would hang these wings and everything, and then the wind would blow, and they would go all over the place, and the musicians' music from the orchestra pit was blowing all over the place. And it ended up that they hardly ever opened the roof for a Civic Light Opera because of the wind.
Yeah, they spent all that money for the roof, and they couldn't use it.
And actually, I think before they finally tore it down, the roof hadn't been opened for ages.
It's been years.
Probably sealed shut. But anyway, it's kind of a funny story. But that happens when you're trying to play outside.
Right.
Yeah. Well, they're not outside. They're indoors at the Butler Intermediate High School Auditorium. Great acoustics there for the musicians.
Oh, it's a beautiful hall for music. Absolutely.
Yeah, terrific. The summer concert season opens tomorrow night.
Yeah, I can't believe how fast it's come, but we will be doing concerts pretty much every other week. We'll start tomorrow evening, June 14th, and as always, we start at about 7:30. Concert will end a little bit around 9 o'clock, so it's still kind of light outside, so those that don't really like to drive at dark, you'll still be okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sadly, they can't go to Dairy Queen afterwards right there by the high school, but that's a whole other story. Tomorrow night, we're featuring a local family musician. His name is Jim Colonna. He is actually the third James Colonna. The very first James Colonna that we kind of think about was a longtime musician, and his daughter was a longtime teacher at the Butler School District, Jeanette Colonna Schmidt.
Mm-hmm.
Started many, many people and worked with them on music. Jim is... this will be the third Jim. So actually, his father was a band director in Punxsutawney, and he's going to be there at the concert tonight watching his son. So it's really kind of exciting. And one of the pieces we're doing is called America Forever March, which the first James Colonna wrote the day of Pearl Harbor's bombing. And you know, kind of in reflection upon that historic event and how it made him feel that day and the various themes in that show or in that song.
I am almost positive that my first introduction to attempting to play music was under the tutelage of Mr. Colonna. Now, whether it was from that family or whether
has
it
to
was,
be.
Has
to be. And there was more than just one. There were several several of the Colonnas, and they had bands up in the Punxsie and up north, up in that area.
Well, this would have been in when I was in elementary school. It was in the AC Valley School District. Oh. And this, I never knew the gentleman's first name. It
right.
was just Mr.
Right.
Colonna. I always thought of him as being an older guy, but he might have been 30 for all I know.
In elementary school, everybody
elementary
looks
school.
Old.
I can still remember. It was the first instrument that I ever played. It was a recorder. I think mm-hmm. they call it a recorder, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You had fingering that you used, and it was pretty primitive, I mm-hmm. suppose. But when you get 25 or 30 second graders with their recorders, you can put on a nice little concert.
Yeah, it's a great place to start. We yeah. actually use some of those in our classrooms here at Butler.
Really?
A couple of our teachers do some recorders with them.
Yeah. Well, it would be an early start to such instruments as the sax or the clarinet or something like that. Well, at any rate, I'll never know whether which Colonna that was. But,
well, I'll see. I'll see if I can talk to Jeanette and or even Jim tonight and see which of the family members worked at the AC Valley. I'm sure it had to be one of the crew because, as I said, if you look down through, with Jeanette and then her kids went into music. So Jana Karenbauer teaches for the school district. And, you know, her brother, Marty, went into the military. Mm-hmm. Her sister is a teacher. And then if you look at the next generation, which is starting now, Todd and Jana's daughter, Kayla, that's Jeanette's grandchild, is going to Slippery Rock University majoring in music education.
so she'll be doing it too.
This will be fourth generation, you know, of that line that's going into this field of music.
Tomorrow night's the opening concert for the summer series. What are some of the titles on the program for tomorrow?
Oh, we're doing some Cole Porter. We're going to have some marches. We're doing an English folk suite. So there's, once again, just like we always try to do, there's going to be something for everyone.
That was a real part of the philosophy of the late Blaise Garnotti, who I got to know a little bit, nothing like you, of mm-hmm. course, but I got to know Blaise fairly well. And he always made sure that he had a wide variety of music on the program. Sometimes stuff you'd never expect from a community band.
The thing that he taught me, and he was obviously one of my professors there as well, is as you're looking to program, if you're doing a band or a high school group, a third of it should be for the group playing, to challenge them. A third of it should be for the conductor, things that the conductor really is passionate about. And then the other third should be for the audience, strictly just for entertainment. And he said, if you do it really, really well, nobody's going to know which third is for who. So that's always my goal, is to try to make sure that as I'm programming things, the band is challenged, I'm having fun, and the audience is connecting. But it can be tough. And not everybody's going to love every single song you play, but we try to make sure there's enough for everyone.
I never heard that philosophy before, but I watched Blaise many times as he was conducting, and he had fun when he was on the podium.
Yes, he did.
He had fun. Yeah. Boy, just thinking about him, it's fond memories, huh?
I know. I can't believe, it's been about 10 years since he passed. And, I look at the fact I've been teaching for 26 years now. And so many of the things that I do, I still look back and think, yeah, I know where I got that from. So I had some terrific role models, growing up and watching, from Bob Matchett at Seneca Valley and Tom Anthony and Jim Shaw, and then even at Slip Rock with Blaze and Terry Steele. And, I've been very blessed. And I think the reason I still have so much fun is all those guys that taught me, they had fun too.
We'll take a quick break. We'll talk more with Jeff Croner about the rest of the summer concert season for the Musicians Concert Band in just a moment. One of our sponsors on the program today is the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. Now, it's going to be probably the better part of a month yet before they start their Saturday pickups of excess produce from backyard gardeners, but still time for you to designate, a couple of plants in your backyard garden for the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. They've run this program for several summers now, and it has been truly great. For you can imagine what a treat it is for the folks who rely on the food bank of the Society of St. Vincent de Paul to get fresh, locally grown vegetables. And they're not asking for all of your stuff, you know, just a couple of pepper plants or a tomato plant here and there. And if you've got excess, most folks do, even after they've given their tomatoes to Aunt Martha and the neighbors and everything else. Don't let them go to waste. They'll have regular Saturday morning collections starting soon. We'll tell you when that's all set to go. And then imagine the joy of the clients of the food bank when they get to partake of these fresh vegetables. Good for them. Good for the food bank, too. And it's good for you. You have a good feeling about it. So think about that. And if you're still putting in plants, late tomatoes or anything else, put in a couple of extra ones for the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. They like to say we stand tallest when we stoop to help others. Wonderful thought. Opening night is tomorrow night for the Musicians Concert Band. There will be several other concerts, though, and generally speaking, it's every other week, you said, Jeff.
That's correct, until the very last one. So tomorrow is the 14th. 2 weeks from now will be Thursday, June 28th, and that's where I'm just going to pick some charts that I really enjoy. There again, it's going to be a really neat variety. We're going to go from playing the song Mars from the Holst suite, which is just a very powerful piece.
Gustav Holst, is that right?
Holst, that's correct.
Yeah. Wrote The Planets.
This is part of The Planets. Yeah. You know, the Mars is part of that. We're going to do just some fun songs, you know, such as, you know, maybe James Bond themes from some of the Bond movies, and just things that I think are going to be a lot of fun for the audience. On July 12th, we're going to actually feature some of the professors from the Slippery Rock University Music Department that play with our band, and they've each chosen some music that they're going to conduct and work with, and with this band's origins really kind of stemming from SRU, I thought it'd be a great way to give them an opportunity to showcase the brilliant educators we have at Slippery Rock. Then the 26th of July is going to be Showtime. So I'm going to pick a lot of Broadway and movies, themes, and songs that just, you know, I think is just always fun, and it helps you get into your mind's eye watching that movie. And then the very last one is, that's the only one that won't be 2 weeks. It's going to be the following week on August 2nd. We're going to have Mary and Kevin Gibbons' big band play, and it's going to be a night of swing charts. Glenn Miller, Duke Ellington, Count Basie,
Dorsey,
just we're doing some, Harry James, just some fun things. We just did a concert last night up in Alameda Park that the audience just loved. It's not jazz. It's not the highbrow stuff that everybody just runs away from. This is when the big band was just, this is what we're doing. All the standards that you can just sit back, close your eyes, and you know, maybe it wasn't your time, maybe it was your parents' time, or even your grandparents listening, but just some great stuff. So it's going to be a terrific season.
Good music encompasses many, many eras. I know a lot of folks would be surprised to know that many movie themes are actually pieces from the classical composers back in the 1800s. They might not recognize it as Beethoven or Chopin or something like that, but they're often still used in movies today.
Absolutely. I still think 100 years from now, when people look back at the classical era of right now, they're going to be looking at John Williams, and they're going to be looking at these gentlemen and ladies that are writing for these movies, because they're just such memorable themes that, you know, when the orchestra do their pops and their movie nights, they sell out. This is what people of this generation really enjoy connecting. And I think 100 years from now, they're going to look back and John Williams is going to be our Mozart.
Or maybe Henry Mancini,
Absolutely.
Number two.
Absolutely. That's our Beethoven.
Moon River. The Musicians Concert Band has been performing, this will be the 33rd performance season.
33rd season.
Wow. Wow.
Means I must be getting old, because I played with them. The very first year the band started, I was 18. So, yeah, that puts me at 51. That's been my whole, over almost two-thirds of my life I've been a part of this group.
Would that have been Blaze whenever?
Yes, sir.
And so how did he ever find you when you were only 18 years old?
Well, I was studying privately from a gentleman named Terry Steele, who happened to be the other alto saxophone player in the band. And Blaze asked him if he had anyone he knew, and Terry invited me to play. And that was the beginning. From that point forward.
It's been a thrill for you. Oh. You were just coming out of high school, and you're
sitting beside my mentor.
All these other guys.
Yeah, it was, and it was actually for graduation at Slippery Rock. I'll never forget it. We were in the stadium on platforms underneath a tent. And we were playing, you know, Pomp and Circumstance and various things. And then we did some other music. And then the band went on through and had a summer series with that up along in the pavilion or up beside Miller Auditorium or over in Slippery Rock Park. And that was the very first year that, you know, then the other that summer I also played my very first big band job with the Anthony James Band. So with the Ciprians, you know, I got to play a part of that. And that was the beginning of my love of performing.
Is there anyone who has been around since the very beginning, since way back in the first performance 33 years ago?
Well, we just talked about the Anthony James Band and the Ciprians. Jim Ciprian Sr. has never missed a practice or a performance of the Musicians Concert Band since the beginning. He's the only one. You know, everyone else, I have people that have been a part of the band for the 33 years, but they've had to miss maybe here or there. He is just, he's the rock. We're hoping we can get him back to playing this summer. But, yeah, there's a couple gentlemen. Corky Whitaker's played in it for many years. Jim Cunningham. Vince Sanzotti is going to, he played up through last year. He's going to need to take a hiatus this summer. But we're hoping to get Jim back. So there's a handful, but, yeah.
Who are, you've mentioned several individuals who are well-known musicians and music educators here in the immediate Butler area. Who are the musicians in the Musicians Concert Band?
Well, these are people that are either music educators or retired educators, music majors at Slippery Rock or one of the universities that are local, or people that had the ability and could have majored in music but chose just a different career path. Mm-hmm. So we've had lawyers and accountants, and we've had, you know, presidents of banks, all the way through down to students that have just graduated high school and are going to be majoring in music this fall that I've invited to be a part of this because I want to continue to challenge them musically and, you know, also and add some of that youth to the band. But it's really, it's just musicians from all over. We have people drive as far from Erie to come down and play with us, Washington County, and nobody gets paid. This is all just volunteer. There's nobody on this, including myself, nobody makes a dime. Every penny of the donations at the door goes towards advertising, goes towards buying music, goes towards, you know, maybe putting a guest conductor up in a hotel. It's all just right back in, you know.
You ask for a $5 donation at the door?
We do. We've never turned anybody down. If you don't have $5 because things are tight, that's fine. Just be our guest. We'd love to have you. We have people to pay more. I have people that stop me in the lobby and say we should charge more, and I always encourage them, if they feel that way, that we'd love to take any donations above and beyond to help us. But it is a $5 recommended donation, but as I said, we just love to fill the place.
Well, people may not realize how expensive music is these days. I know in my church choir, every once in a while, they'll pull out an oldie but a goodie, and you'll see the price up in the corner, you know, 70 cents. And nowadays they're $3.95, $4.95 for each piece of music.
For every song that we perform, if I were to purchase it new, it runs anywhere from $80 to $150 per song. And we typically do about 10 songs per show. So you're looking at $800 to $1,500 just for music. Now, we try to pull from our library because being a group that's been performing for 32 years, I have an extensive library. But you also want to do some new things as well. So you're right. It's a very expensive proposition just to buy that music and have it.
So many of these individuals are highly talented. And for the teachers, for the music educators, they must relish a chance to, instead of having to teach, get out and play, you know, kind of show their stuff. I assume because of their expertise, you don't need a whole lot of rehearsal time.
One of the special things about this group, unlike many others, we rehearse, the members of the band will get the music tonight. We'll rehearse for 2 hours. We never go long. It's from 7 o'clock until 9 o'clock. When we're done, some of the musicians will take it home and practice a little bit tomorrow. But beyond that, they get one shot tonight. Tomorrow night we perform what we get tonight. The concert 2 weeks from now will be the same thing. They'll receive the music when they show up on Wednesday night. We practice it for 2 hours. The next night we do a show. And that takes a special type of musician to be able to read it that quickly, fix the mistakes they make, and then perform it at the level we do the following evening.
And a special kind of conductor, too. That's not easy either.
It's probably much more stressful than being a teacher, because as a teacher, I have months to rehearse with the students and get them there. You're right, because if I make a mistake, and it's happened even in performances where you just let your mind wander, you got to be able to jump right in and hope the band's going to save you, just like you as the conductor save them.
And you're in front of your peers, too. That's kind of a little bit different. Well, it's a great tradition, 33rd performance season of the Musicians Concert Band, and we're lucky to have them again this summer. And the summer concert series starts tomorrow night. 7:30 concert time?
7:30.
Butler Intermediate High School tomorrow night. And then again on the 28th of June, July 12th, July 26th, and wrapping up on August 2nd. Jeff Croner is the director for many, many years now. Good to see you again, Jeff. Thanks for stopping in.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. More to come on It's Your Turn here on WISR. Coming up, we're going to check in with a spokesperson for the Republican National Committee, getting his view on the Singapore summit. You know, the reviews have been kind of mixed, some good, some neutral, some bad. I would expect the Republican National Committee is pretty positive about the summit that took place earlier this week in Singapore. We'll talk with Mark Lauter coming up on the It's Your Turn program in just a moment or so. Back after these words.
Do you have missing teeth or wear dentures? You may have heard of or are considering dental implants. Hi, this is Dr. Bob Todd of Butler Smiles Dental Care. There are many options available with dental implants, and making the right choice can be confusing. I have been placing dental implants since 2004, both full-size traditional implants and small diameter or mini dental implants. There are indications for both, but more and more we are using mini dental implants in a variety of innovative ways. They are easier to place, causing less discomfort, are less costly, and can frequently be used immediately after placement, allowing you to get back to eating the foods you like or smiling again right away. Traditional implants typically have a 4-month healing time before they can be used. I invite you to call our office at 282-7774 to schedule a free consultation to see if mini dental implants are the right solution for your dental problems, or visit us on the web at butlersmiles.com.
A little bit of an update, listeners, from Washington, D.C., on the Singapore summit of earlier this week. We speak on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR with Mark Lauter. He is a former special assistant to President Trump and a former press secretary for the vice president as well. Mark Lauter, nice to have you with us for a few minutes here today.
Thanks for having me.
So can you give us a thumbnail look at just what came out of the big summit in Singapore earlier this week?
I think the biggest takeaway is that we have established a blueprint from which the president and the North Korean leader can hopefully build a foundation for lasting peace on the Korean Peninsula after 70 years of hostilities, warfare, and then isolation. Right now, we're at a position where we can finally achieve our goal of complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization of the North Korean Peninsula.
There are some who say we've seen these kind of promises from North Korea before, and they've always broken them.
And you're absolutely right. And President Trump went into these meetings and is going into this next step with his eyes wide open. That's why the maximum pressure campaign continues. North Korea continues to face all the sanctions that the president and our allies have levied. And as soon as they start to take concrete steps toward denuclearization, then we can start to move in a position where the sanctions can be removed.
President Trump said after the historic meeting that he expected that to begin almost immediately. Is there any updated word on that, Mark?
Well, what we're seeing right now is that the North Korean leader had agreed to start to dismantle an engine testing facility for their intercontinental ballistic missiles. We expect to see those things happen quickly. And in the meantime, you have Secretary of State Pompeo headed over to the region where he's going to Seoul and to Beijing. And then later, possibly as early as next week, he'll be meeting with North Korea to begin to put meat on the bones of that initial framework.
The initial reaction from some in South Korea was a little bit surprising. They apparently were not ready for President Trump's announcement that the war games were going to cease.
Well, in this case, these are annual exercises that typically take place in the spring. They were just recently conducted, and they're not due to be conducted again until next year. So that gives us approximately 9 to 10 months to see if North Korea is actually committed to denuclearization. If they backtrack on their initial commitments or don't follow through, the president can easily order the military to resume those exercises. But at this point, this is a goodwill gesture that really costs nothing to the United States or to our allies at this point. And now it falls to Kim Jong-un to see if he's actually serious in following through and making the region a safer place and doing something that will benefit his people down the long term.
There have been some reports that he received an invitation to come to the White House. Is that confirmed, or are those just rumors?
The president had mentioned that they extended invitations to each other to visit to Washington, D.C. and to North Korea. But the key is when the time is appropriate. So if we continue to see positive progress on the framework that has been outlined and building upon that, then there could be a time when both of those leaders could visit the other's respective countries. But right now, it's an invitation. We need to see concrete action, which is what the president wants. And as long as things are moving in the right direction, then we can take things in the necessary steps as it goes through.
What do you think brought about this thaw in relations? I mean, just a few months ago, these two leaders were, hurling insults at each other, and suddenly they meet. What broke the dam? The release of the prisoners, do you think?
I think it was the maximum pressure campaign that had been applied by the president and by our allies in the region and other countries like China really took an economic toll on that country. And then also, I think that they saw the strong leadership being shown by the president in the fact that he is going to confront the threat that they posed at the time with whatever means were necessary at the time. And they realized that denuclearization is going to happen. The only question is on whose terms. Is it going to be at the negotiating table, or would it be in some sort of a conflict? But the president was absolutely clear that the world will not tolerate a nuclear-armed North Korea with the means to deliver those missiles to the United States or to her allies around the world. The only question was, how was the North Korean leadership going to resolve that issue? And it's good to show that they have initially shown signs of wanting to do that at the negotiating table.
So China is tightening sanctions against North Korea as well. From my limited knowledge of history in that area, I know up until the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russians were really the ones that kind of propped up the North Korean economy. But that all ended when the Soviet Union collapsed, and it's my understanding that China has been the big supporter. They're having some doubts right now?
China had been a big supporter. They had actually curtailed a lot of the exports going into that country, and they also took the very real step of buying a lot less coal from North Korea, which put a definite economic impact on that country. And because of their cooperation, and they could still do more, the president has said that, and he would like to continue to see them to tighten that grip. But they definitely had an impact and were partners in helping to bring about the meeting that we saw earlier this week in Singapore.
The optics were certainly good, were they not, with the handshake and all of the other television pictures that we saw?
It was a great first step. I think the president has been very clear on that this was the beginning of the process, not the end of it. And so while we were happy to see that this step was taken, what we need to see now are continued talks, continued positive momentum and movement from North Korea, so we can continue building on what was started in Singapore this week.
The president just back in the United States early this morning. Someone asked me, Mark, whether or not Singapore is exactly halfway around the world from us, 12-hour time difference. Someone said, is that a nonstop flight from Singapore to D.C.? I said, I don't know. Do you happen to know if they refueled somewhere, or can they do that in one clip?
I do know they stopped overnight in Honolulu in Hawaii at the Air Force Base there to refuel, and that is not unusual. I actually went with the vice president last year to Asia and to that region, along with Australia and others. And we also, you know, you typically stop and refuel along the way.
Have Democrats responded favorably, in your opinion, to this historic summit, Mark, or no?
Now, by and large, they have not, which is not surprising. Unfortunately, they have just become the party of resistance to anything that the president says or does. And but you know, this is not about headlines in Washington D.C. or in New York. It's really about setting the long term goal of denuclearization and achieving it, which is the right thing for the world. And while the Democrats and many in the media will take their shots and do those kinds of partisan games that they're off to do, the president's focused on the end result, and we'll get there. I'm confident.
The president said in a statement just before he left Singapore, actually yesterday, that he had a good feeling when he looked North Korean chairman in the eye. Had a good feeling. That's kind of the way President Trump operates, isn't it?
Absolutely. As someone who's had the privilege of working alongside of him in the White House, he is such an engaging person, but he has a connection with people. He has a very quick read on whether there's going to be progress or whether he's dealing with someone across the table who's not necessarily always being forthright. It was a great start, but again, it was just a start. And I think everyone, including the president, knows that what happens in the days and weeks to come is what the important focus should be on.
Do you think the president has sort of an unofficial deadline to see some action, or is he just going to play it by ear?
I think we'll start to see more when Secretary Pompeo gets over there in the coming days and weeks. That's where the difficult work of putting the framework into words to be followed with actions is going to take place. And I think so we'll start to see pretty quickly if North Korea is serious about its promises.
Former secretary, former special assistant to President Trump, former press secretary to the vice president, Mark Lauder. Mark, thanks for taking some time out to chat with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So long now.
Thank you.
Final guest on this segment of It's Your Turn. Coming up in a moment, he is Jeffrey Mount Varner. We'll be talking about Home Alive. One of our sponsors on the program today is Gone Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center. They package your items for shipping. Simple as that, and they do make it simple. You don't have to worry about finding the right size box or the bubble wrap or any of that stuff. They do it for you. You can ship it any way you want. U.S. Postal Service, UPS, FedEx, your choice. By the way, they also offer copying service, scanning, faxing. You can even rent a temporary mailbox there. And they have local honey, too. Delicious. They're at 140 Shockey Lane, just off Newcastle Road, right behind King's and Villa Grande restaurants, in the Shockey Mini Storage Complex. Your friendly neighborhood shipping center, that's Going Postal Butler. Phone them at 724-841-0044.
Sports injury got you down? Sprains and strains or decreased range of motion making it difficult to enjoy your favorite activities? Try Lumix Laser Therapy, treatment offered exclusively by Applewood Chiropractic Health and Fitness Center. Laser therapy sessions are open to the public, so you don't have to be a chiropractic patient to receive treatments administered solely by Dr. Lucas. The goal at Applewood is to make this affordable for everyone by offering treatment packages in sessions of 1, 6, and 10. To learn more or to schedule your Lumix Laser treatment, call Applewood Chiropractic at 724-283-0518.
Welcome, listeners. My name is Dave Malarkey, and nice to have you with us on the It's Your Turn program here today on WISR. On this segment, we're going to be talking with guest Jeffrey Mount Varner. He is a medical doctor, and he is the author of a book entitled Home Alive, 11 Must Steps to Surviving Encounters with the Police. Dr. Varner, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us for a few minutes here today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about why you wrote this book. What inspired you to write Home Alive, Doctor?
Well, I am a practicing emergency medicine doctor with 20 years experience, and so I deal with death and injury regularly.
Mm-hmm.
Combine that with the fact that I have an 11-year-old son who was old enough to be killed by the police. I decided that I needed to do my part in this American crisis, and this was my community give back. So after 2,000 hours of research and, like, interviews, This is what I found and what I was told was going to be helpful to all citizens.
Now, you're an emergency room physician. Obviously, you see a lot of the results of when things go bad. But, you know, you're not an attorney. You're not a police officer. Are you qualified to speak on this issue, doctor?
That is a great question, and it is precisely what makes this a unique book. I am an emergency medicine physician with a unique perspective as it relates to death, pain, and injury. And so the goal of the book is to immediately save lives. It does not deal with the social, legal, historical aspect of this problem. It deals with one unique aspect, and that is get your child and loved one home alive no matter what. And as a result of being an ER doctor and my thousands of interactions with officers, and combine that with the fact that two of my sisters are judges in the area, it gave me unique access to people and people who were very credible and very honest in their help as I wrote this book.
Listeners, a little bit, first of all, about our guest, Dr. Jeffrey Mount Varner, is a Harvard graduate. He is a board-certified emergency medicine physician, and he's a father. And he emphasizes, in fact, it's in bold print on the back cover of your book, doctor, this is not a police-bashing book. So you want to emphasize that from the get-go, right?
Yeah, I want to emphasize that from the get-go, because often we are distracted and lost because of we always want to defend our officers, as well as I do too. But this is not about them. This is about you. This is about people and their kids and their loved ones, and steps that we must take when pulled over or stopped by the police.
Are you, I think everyone realizes that these statistics show that a disproportionate number of those being killed in these situations are young black males. Are you directing your book and your advice specifically, doctor, to young black males?
So you're right. While young black males are bearing the brunt of this American crisis, the part that other citizens or that the citizenry as a whole forget is that there are whites, mainly young white males, that are being killed too. So the book is directed towards all American families, but it does put a special emphasis on black males. And in fact, there are two chapters that are specifically dedicated to black males. But as an ER doctor who is concerned about saving lives, the book is written for anyone, but mainly parents who have young children or who have young teens and tweens, because the stop will come, and I think we would I think that we need to prepare our children.
This is a question I feel almost silly asking you, because it's obviously very complex, but you discuss in your book how to reduce the number of violent altercations between police and African-American male youth. Can you give us a capsule summary of that? How can we reduce these number of violent altercations?
Well, I think first, being steeped in the community. And what I mean by that is that 95% of the interactions that the officers have are usually with that 5% of quote bad element.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an automatic implicit bias that develops. Whereas if in their downtime or if there are other times, they can go to the schools, not for disciplinary reasons, but get to know the community. A great place to visit are the barbershops and the beauty shops, because that's where you've got open and honest communication. That's where you can impact it. In addition, I believe that the police, churches, and the other citizenry, they need to get together and train young people in terms of how to interact with police officers. And that is so important. In the state of Virginia, as of July, they're requiring all new people who are getting driver's license to go through how to interact with police officer training. So they're well ahead of this curve.
Now, that's a great idea. Can you tell us, before we have to take a quick break here, what typically goes wrong when police pull over a black driver? Can you give us a little bit about what are some of the common ways that it goes south?
Well, I think that one of the most common ways is that there is a miscommunication. And while I am a black male, I can just share my experience that and this was prior to writing the book, is that often there's a misunderstanding, there's a misreading of nonverbals, there's a misreading of eye contact. And so and what I think that we all should accept, black, white, Asian, and American, is that when you're pulled over, your ultimate and immediate goal is to, A, make it home alive, but the way you do that is you must initially make the officer feel safe. It's not about you. It's about making the officer feel safe, because you want to prevent an escalation of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Excellent point. And by the way, something that methinks would apply to any individual, certainly not just a young black male, to anybody who's pulled over for something as simple as a turn signal violation or something like that, right?
Right. And, it's a scary time for anyone who is pulled over.
Exactly.
And so I think if you prepare in advance when that time happens, there's a less sense of fear. Still stressful, but there's a control fear there.
Mm-hmm. A quick break, listeners. This is fascinating stuff. We'll come back and pick up our conversation with Dr. Jeffrey Mount Varner about his book, Home Alive, 11 Must Steps to Surviving Encounters with Police. In fact, when we come back, we'll talk specifically about some of those steps that he outlines in his book. Back in a moment.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick two is 0000. Pick 3, 223. The pick 4, 8926. Pick 5, 64585. The wild ball for each of those is 6. The treasure hunt, 7, 9, 11, 25, and 26. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $69,000.
Hop the bus. Leave the driving up to us. We're going your way.
Butler Transit now provides weekday transportation to and from Pittsburgh for just $5 one way. Pittsburgh destinations include downtown and the North Shore. Whether you're looking for a less expensive commute to work or wanting to visit the attractions of the Pittsburgh area, let the bus take you there. Senior 65 and up, ride free with a senior pass. For more information, visit butlertransit.com.
Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us. We're going your way.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us a little bit late, that's fine. Here on It's Your Turn on WISR Today. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest visits with us by telephone. He is Dr. Jeffrey Mount Varner, MD. He is a physician, an emergency room physician, Harvard graduate, and he's the author, for the purposes of our discussion today, of a book. And by the way, this is not War and Peace. It's a compact book. It's a little less than 100 pages, a paperback. The title is Home Alive, 11 Must Steps to Surviving Encounters with the Police. And if you aren't with us for the first part of our conversation, we emphasize again, Dr. Varner does, this is not a police bashing book. So you talk about 11 steps needed to safely get through any interaction. Can you mention a couple of these? Because I know you detail all of them in your book, Doctor.
Sure. One of them it says cry. When you get pulled over and things begin to like escalate, cry. People say, well, isn't that just ingenious? And I say no, because the overall goal is what? To make it home alive. So anything you can do to de-escalate or to slow that situation down, or to assist the officer in viewing you in a more human way, in a way that makes them want to help you, then you do that. in my own life, for instance, I am a congenital stutterer, have been that way for the last 50 years of my life, and I am 50 years old. And so I often just let myself go, and I stutter. What that does is it slows the situation down. It allows the officer to like humanize me. In addition, this one may seem strange, but bear with me. Don't look the officer in the eye for too long, especially if the situation is escalating. The reason for that is it two things happen. It allows for the officer to interpret and maybe misinterpret how you are looking at them. And then it also allows it allows you to misinterpret the officer's look. Mm. So it's better that, hey, you give brief eye contact and look forward, and whatever you do, de-escalate the situation.
I'm thinking that there are probably some people in law enforcement who might take umbrage with the need for your book and some of your advice, acting in a self-preservation mode out of fear. Have you had any reaction from law enforcement, from police officers about your book? Have you had any positive support for it, sir?
I've had both. I've had positive support, and I've had reaction. And as I speak to them, I tell them, I highlight, this is not about you, officer. This is about America and making America a safer place. And it's also about assisting you in getting home alive. The facts are the facts. 3.4 Americans are killed each day by the police. That's almost double any other industrialized country in the world. And it's going to take years to fix this problem. Years. What this book does, it offers immediate life-saving solutions that when applied, it immediately begins to save lives. And this is not about police bashing, and the book does not do that. But it's also about speaking about the facts of the data. And the data is very clear. We have a problem, but there are fixable solutions that are going to take time.
I'm glad you mentioned it. I know you acknowledge in your book the fact that, hey, police officers want to make it home alive, too. And we had not too long ago here in the Pittsburgh area a tragic case where an officer pulled over an individual for very high speeding, you know, 90, 100 miles an hour. The officer got out of the car, walked up, and he was shot dead through the window by the driver.
Oh, wow.
Just like that. So, I mean, officers want to make it home alive, too, and you acknowledge that. Can you tell me, Dr. Varner, what about the reaction you've had from the African-American community? Positive, negative, any reaction at all to your book, Home Alive?
There has been a great deal of reaction, a great deal of support for the book as well. But what I found key is those people who have kids have a more favorable and intense reaction. Young people, admittedly, because I have spoken about this at colleges, they are less drawn to the book because if we think about it, when we were 18, 19, and 20, the world was great, it was fair, we could do we felt as though we could do anything. We were invincible. So to tell an 18 or 19-year-old, hey, make the officer feel safe. If things escalate, don't look him in the eye, and you've got to be humble. That's not a message that they're prepared to hear. Whereas parents, because of our experiences and our unique desire to get our children home alive, we can hear it. And when we hear it, we've got to teach it to our kids. And let me just add, as I say to my 11-year-old son, Joffrey, and my 14-year-old daughter, Brooke, when stopped, if stopped, if you come home, I can fix you. No matter what happened during that stop, I can fix you. Mm. But if you're killed, there's nothing I can do. So do what you have to do. Be who you need to be. Act how you need to act. Get away from that situation alive. And whatever went wrong, if something went wrong, then we can fix that later.
There are more listeners' concrete tips in Dr. Vorner's book, Home Alive. Some of them are common sense, but as the doctor said, when anybody is pulled over, the adrenaline starts to pump. You get excited, you get irritated, sometimes you get mad. You talk about things like never running, never making any sudden movements, never keeping your hands in your pocket, never resisting the police. How did you develop these 11 steps, Dr. Vorner? You talked with, I'm assuming you talked with police officers and judges and stuff like that?
Yeah, I had unique access as being a practicing ER doctor and someone who's ran a level 1 trauma center. I knew